Hello, hello, welcome back to another section of A Gentleman in Moscow by Immortals. Hope you're enjoying the holiday season. The year is so quickly coming to a close, so we've got quite a bit of work to do. Got this much left in the book. If you are following along in a copy such as mine, we've got about 140 pages to go, I think, which is doable. It is doable in this last week, so we're gonna get it done. I think this might be another kind of long section here. I might have to record it in two parts, but we are on book four now. And so yeah, we're starting book four. If you're liking this, give me a thumb, subscribe so you don't miss the rest of the book. And let me know what you want me to read in 2022, because that's like coming up. Anyway, we are on page 321. The year is now 1950. And this chapter is titled Adagio Andante Allegro. In the blink of an eye. That was how, on the 21st of June, Count Alexander Rostov summed up his daughter's journey from 13 to 17, when Vasily remarked on how much she had grown. One moment she is scampering up and down the stairwells, a veritable gadabout, a gadfly, a ne'er-do-well, and the next she is a young woman of intelligence and refinement. And this was largely true, for if the Count had been premature in characterizing Sophia as demure when she was 13, she had perfectly anticipated her persona on the cusp of adulthood. With fair skin and long black hair, but for the white stripe that fell from the spot of her own old injury, Sophia could sit for hours listening to music in their study. She could stitch for hours with Marina in the stitching room or chat for hours with Emil in the kitchen without shifting once in her chair. When Sophia was just five, the Count had assumed, naively perhaps, that she would grow up to be a dark-haired version of her mother. But while Sophia shared Nina's clarity of perception and confidence of opinion, she was entirely different in demeanor. Where her mother was prone to express her impatience with the slightest of the world's imperfections, Sophia seemed to presume that if the earth spun awry upon occasion, it was generally a well-intentioned planet. And where Nina would not hesitate to cut someone off in mid-assertion in order to make a contrary point, and then declare the matter decided once and for all, Sophia would listen so attentively and with such sympathetic smile that her interlocutor, having been given free rein to express his views at considerable length, often found his voice petering out as he began to question his own premises. Demure, that was the only word for it, and the transition had occurred in the blink of an eye. When you reach our age, Vasily, it all goes by so quickly. Whole seasons seem to pass without leaving the slightest mark on our memory. How true, agreed the concierge, as he sorted through an allotment of tickets. But surely there is a comfort to be taken from that, continued the Count, for even as the weeks begin racing by in a blur for us, they are making the greatest of impressions upon our children. When one turns 17 and begins to experience that first period of real independence, one's senses are so alert, one's sentiments so finely attuned, that every conversation, every look, every laugh may be writ indelibly upon one's memory. And the friends that one happens to make in those impressionable years, one will meet them forever after with a welling of affection. Having expressed this paradox, the Count happened to look across the lobby, where Grisha was lugging the luggage of one guest toward the front desk as Jenya lugged the luggage of another toward the door. Perhaps it is a matter of celestial balance, he reflected, a sort of cosmic equilibrium. Perhaps the aggregate experience of time is a constant, and thus for our children to establish such vivid impressions of this particular June, we must relinquish our claims upon it. So that they might remember, we must forget, Vasily soon summed up. Exactly, said the Count. So that they might remember, we must forget. But should we take umbrage at the fact? Should we feel shortchanged by the notion that their experiences for the moment may be richer than ours? I think not, for it is hardly our purpose at this late stage to log a new portfolio of lasting memories. Rather, we should be dedicating ourselves to ensuring that they taste freely of experience. and we must do so without trepidation. Rather than tucking in blankets and buttoning up coats, we must have faith in them to tuck and button on their own. And if they fumble with their newfound liberty, we must remain composed, generous, judicious. We must encourage them to venture out from under our watchful gaze, and then sigh with pride when they pass at last through the revolving doors of life. As if to illustrate, the Count gestured generously and judiciously toward the hotel's entrance, while giving an exemplary sigh. Then he tapped the concierge's desk. By the way, do you happen to know where she is? Vasily looked up from his tickets. Miss Sophia? Yes. She is in the ballroom with Victor, I believe. Ah, she must be helping him polish the floors for an upcoming banquet. No, not Victor Ivanovich. Victor Stepanovich. Victor Stepanovich? Yes, Victor Stepanovich. Skardovsky, the conductor of the orchestra at the piazza. If, in part, the Count had been trying to express to Vasily how in our golden years a passage of time can be so fleet and leave so little an impression upon our memory that it is almost as if it never had occurred, well then, here was a perfect example. For 3 minutes, it took the Count to travel from a delightful conversation at the concierge's desk to the ballroom, where he had grabbed a scoundrel by the lapels, had also passed in the blink of an eye. Why, it had passed so quickly that the Count did not remember knocking the luggage from Grisha's grip as he marched down the hall, nor did he remember throwing open the door and shouting, "Aha!" nor yanking the would-be Casanova up off the love seat where he had intertwined his fingers with Sophia's. No, the Count did not remember any of it. But to ensure a celestial balance and the equilibrium of the cosmos, this mustachioed scoundrel in evening clothes was sure to remember every single second for the rest of his life. "Your Excellency," he implored, as he dangled in the air, "there has been a terrible misunderstanding." Looking up at the startled face above his fists, the Count confirmed that there had been no misunderstanding. It was definitely the very same fellow who waved his baton so blithely on the bandstand in the piazza, and though he apparently knew how to produce an honorific in a timely fashion, he was clearly as villainous a viper as had ever slithered from the underbrush of Eden. But whatever his level of villainy, the current situation did pose a quandary. For once you have hoisted a scoundrel by the lapels, what are you to do with him? At least when you have a fellow by the scruff of the neck, you can carry him out the door and toss him down the stairs. But when you have him by the lapels, he isn't so easy to dispense with. Before the Count could solve this conundrum, Sophia expressed a conundrum of her own. "Papa, what are you doing?" "Go to your room, Sophia. This gentleman and I have a few matters to discuss before I give him the drubbing of a lifetime." "The drubbing of a lifetime? But Victor Stepanovich is my instructor." Keeping one eye on the scoundrel, the Count glanced at his daughter with the other. "Your what? My instructor. He is teaching me piano." The so-called instructor nodded 4 times in quick succession. Without releasing his hold on the cad's lapels, the Count leaned his head back so that he could study the mise-en-scene with a little more care. Upon closer inspection, the love seat the two had been sitting on did, in fact, appear to be the bench of a piano, and in the spot where their hands had been intertwined, there was an orderly row of ivory keys. The Count tightened his grip. "So that's your game, is it? Seducing young women with jitterbugs?" The so-called instructor looked aghast. "Absolutely not, Your Excellency. I have never seduced a soul with a jitterbug. We have been playing scales and sonatas. I myself trained at the conservatory, where I received the Mussorgsky medal. I only conduct in the restaurant in order to make ends meet." Taking advantage of the Count's hesitation, he gestured toward the piano with his head. "Let us show you. Sophia, why don't you play the nocturne we have been practicing?"
"The nocturne?"
"As you wish, Victor Stepanovich," Sophia replied politely, then turned to the keyboard in order to arrange her sheet music.
"Perhaps," the instructor said to the Count with another nod toward the piano, "if I could just..."
"Oh," said the Count. "Yes, of course." The Count set him back on the ground and gave his lapels a quick brushing.
Then the instructor joined his student on the bench. All right, Sophia. Straightening her posture, Sophia laid her fingers on the keys. Then, with the utmost delicacy, she began to play. At the sound of the first measure, the count took two steps back. Were those eight notes familiar to him? Did he recognize them in the least? Why, he would have known them if he hadn't seen them in 30 years, and they happened to enter his compartment on a train. He would have known them if he bumped into them on the streets of Florence at the height of the season. In a word, he would have known them anywhere. It was Chopin, Opus 9, number 2, in E-flat major. As she completed the first iteration of the melody in a perfect pianissimo, and transitioned to the second with its suggestion of rising emotional force, the Count took another two steps back and found himself sitting in a chair. Had he felt pride in Sophia before? Of course he had, on a daily basis. He was proud of her success in school, of her beauty, of her composure, of the fondness with which she had was regarded by all who worked in the hotel. And that is how he could be certain that what he was experiencing at that moment could not be referred to as pride, for there is something knowing in the state of pride. Look, it says, didn't I tell you how special she is, how bright, how lovely? Well, now you can see it for yourself. But in listening to Sophia play Chopin, the Count had left the realm of knowing and entered the realm of astonishment. On one level, he was astonished by the revelation that Sophia could play the piano at all. On another, that she tackled the primary and subordinate melodies with such skill. But what was truly astonishing was the sensitivity of her musical expression. One could spend a lifetime mastering the technical aspects of the piano and never achieve a state of musical expression, that alchemy by which the performer not only comprehends the sentiments of the composer, but somehow communicates them to her audience through the manner of her play. Whatever personal sense of heartache Chopin had hoped to express through this little composition, whether it had been prompted by a loss of love or simply the sweet anguish one feels when witnessing a mist on a meadow in the morning, it was right there, ready to be experienced to in its fullest. In the ballroom of the Hotel Metropole 100 years after the composer's death. But how, the question remained, could a 17-year-old girl achieve this feat of expression if not by channeling a sense of loss and longing of her own? As Sophia began the third iteration of the melody, Viktor Stepanovich looked over his shoulder with his eyebrows raised as if to say, "Can you believe it? Have you ever in all your years even imagined?" Then he quickly looked back to the piano and dutifully turned the page for Sophia, almost in the manner of an apprentice turning the page for his master. After the Count had led Viktor Stepanovich into the hall where they could confer for a moment in private, he returned to the ballroom. Finding Sophia still at the piano, he took a seat at her side with his back to the keys. They were both silent. "Why didn't you tell me you were studying the piano?" the Count asked after a moment. "I wanted it to be a surprise," she said, "for your birthday. I didn't mean to upset you. I'm so sorry if I did."
"Sophia, if anyone should be apologizing, it should be me. You have done nothing wrong. On the contrary, that was wonderful, and unambiguously so."
Sophia blushed and looked down at the keyboard. "It is a lovely composition," she said.
"Well, yes," agreed the Count with a laugh. "It is a lovely composition, but it is also a piece of paper with circles, lines, and dots. Nearly every student of piano for a century has learned to play that little bit of Chopin. But for most of them, it is an act of recitation. Only one in 1,000 or even 100,000 can bring the music to life as you just have."
Sophia continued to look at the keyboard. The Count hesitated, and then, with a touch of trepidation, he asked, "Is everything all right?"
Sophia looked up, a little surprised. Then, seeing how grave her father's expression was, she smiled.
"Of course, Papa. Why do you ask?"
The Count shook his head. "I've never played an instrument in my life, but I understand something of music. To have played the opening measures of that piece with feelings so perfectly evocative of heartache, one can only assume that you have drawn on some wellspring of sorrow within yourself." Oh, I see, she said. Then, with the enthusiasm of a young scholar, she began to explain. Viktor Stepanovich calls that the mood. He says that before one plays a note, one must discover an example of the composition's mood hidden away in one's heart. So, for this piece, I think about my mother. I think of how my few memories of her seem to be fading, and then I begin to play. The Count was quiet, overwhelmed by another wave of astonishment.
Does that make sense? Sophia asked.
Abundantly, he said. Then after a moment of reflection, he added, as a younger man, I used to feel the same way about my sister. Every year that passed, it seemed a little more of her had slipped away, and I began to fear that one day I would come to forget her altogether. But the truth is, no matter how much time passes, those we have loved never slip away from us entirely.
They were both quiet now.
Then, looking about him, the Count gestured with his hand. This was a favorite room of hers.
Of your sister's?
No, of your mother's. Sophia looked around with some surprise.
The ballroom?
Most definitely. After the revolution, all the old ways of doing things were abandoned, which was the point, I suppose, but the new ways of doing things had yet to be established. So, all across Russia, all manner of groups, trade unions, citizens, committees, commissariats, gathered in rooms like this one in order to hash things out. The Count pointed to the balcony. When your mother was 9, she would crouch up there behind the balustrade to watch these assemblies for hours on end. She found it all very thrilling. The shuffling of chairs and the heartfelt speeches and the pounding of the gavel. And in retrospect, she was perfectly right. After all, a new course for the country was being charted right before our eyes. But at the time, what with the crawling and the hunching, it just gave me a crick in the neck.
You would go up there too?
Oh, she insisted. The Count and Sophia both smiled. Come to think of it, added the Count after a moment, that's how I came to know your Aunt Marina. Because every other visit to the balcony, I'd split the seam of my pants. Sophia laughed. Then the Count wagged a finger in the manner of one who has remembered something else. Later, when your mother was 13 or 14, she would come here to enact experiments.
Experiments?
Your mother was not one to take anything on faith. If she hadn't witnessed a phenomenon with her own eyes, then as far as she was concerned, it was a hypothesis. And that included all the laws of physics and mathematics. One day, I found her here, testing the principles of Galileo and Newton by dropping various objects from the balcony and timing their descent with a sprinter's watch.
Is that even possible?
It was for your mother.
They were quiet for another moment, then Sophia turned and kissed the Count on the cheek.
When Sophia had gone off to meet a friend, the Count went to the piazza and treated himself to a glass of wine with lunch, something that he had done on a daily basis in his 30s and had rarely done since. Given the morning's revelations, it seemed only appropriate. In fact, when his plate had been cleared and he had dutifully declined dessert, he ordered a second glass. As he leaned back with his wine in hand, he regarded the young man at the neighboring table who was sketching in his sketchbook. Count had noticed him in the lobby the day before with the book in his lap and a small tin of colored pencils at his side. The Count leaned a little to his right.
Landscape portrait or still life?
The young man looked up with a touch of surprise.
Excuse me?
I couldn't help but notice you sketching away. I was just wondering if it was a landscape, a portrait, or still life.
None of the above, I'm afraid, the young man replied politely.
It is an interior.
Of the restaurant?
Yes.
May I see?
The young man hesitated, then handed the Count his book. As soon as the Count had it in hand, he regretted his reference to sketching. The word hardly did the young man's skills as an artist, justice to the young man's skills as an artist, for he had captured the piazza perfectly. The guests at the tables were rendered with the short, bright strokes of Impressionism, adding to the sense that they were engaged in lively conversations, while the waiters, moving deftly between the tables, were rendered in something of a blur. But the suggestive style with which the young man had drawn the people was sharply contrasted by the level of detail with which he had drawn the room itself, The columns, the fountain, the arches were all realized in perfect perspective, to perfect proportion, with every ornament in place.
"It's a wonderful drawing," said the Count, "but I must say your sense of space is particularly exquisite."
The stranger smiled a little wistfully.
"That's because I'm an architect by training, not an artist."
"Are you designing a hotel?" The architect gave a laugh.
"The way things stand, I'd be happy to design a birdhouse."
Given the Count's expression of curiosity, the young man elaborated. "For the time being, there are a lot of buildings being built in Moscow, but little need for architects, so I have taken a job with Intourist. They are putting together a brochure of the city's finer hotels, and I'm drawing the interiors."
Footnote.
What sort of topsy-turvy circumstances could lead to a boom for builders and a bust for architects? Simple. In January, the mayor of Moscow had called a convention of the city's architects to discuss the needs of the capital given the rapid growth of its population. Over the course of 3 days, an excited consensus had quickly formed across the various committees that the time had come for bold new steps. Taking advantage of the latest materials and technologies, they proposed that the city erect towers 40 stories high, with elevators that shot from the lobby to the roof, and apartments that could be configured to suit every individual need, each with a modern kitchen and private bath and plate glass windows emitting natural light. At the closing ceremony of the convention, the mayor, a bald and brutish sort, whom we will have no reason to revisit later, thanked the attendees for their artistry, their ingenuity, and their dedication to the party. "It is satisfying to discover that we are all in agreement," he concluded. "In order to house our fellow comrades as quickly and economically as possible, we must indeed pursue bold new steps. So let us not get bogged down with elaborate designs or bow to aesthetic vanities. Let us apply ourselves instead to a universal ideal that is fitting for our times." Thus was born the golden age of the prefabricated cement-walled five-story apartment building and the 400-square-foot living spaces with ready access to communal bathrooms boasting 4-foot tubs. After all, who has the time to lie down in a bath when your neighbors are knocking at the door? So ingenious was the design of these new apartment buildings, so intuitive their architecture, they could be built from a single page of specifications, regardless of which way the page was oriented. Within 6 months, thousands of them had sprung up on the outskirts of Moscow, like mushrooms after a rain. And so systematic was their realization, you could mistakenly enter any apartment on your block and feel immediately at home. Back to the text, top of 330. "Ah," said the Count, "because a photograph cannot capture the feeling of a place."
"Actually," replied the architect, "because a photograph too readily captures the condition of a place."
"Oh, I see," said the Count, feeling a little insulted on the piazza's behalf. In its defense, he couldn't help pointing out that while the restaurant had been celebrated for its excellence in its time, the room's grandeur had never been defined by its furnishings or architectural details.
"By what, then?" the young man asked.
"The citizenry."
"How do you mean?"
The Count turned his chair so that he could better face his neighbor. "In my day, I had the luxury of doing a good bit of travel, and I can tell you from personal experience that the majority of hotel restaurants, not simply in Russia, you understand, but across Europe, were designed for and have served the guests of the hotel. But this restaurant wasn't, and hasn't. It was designed to be and has been a gathering place for the entire city of Moscow." The Count gestured toward the center of the room. "For most of the last 40 years, on a typical Saturday night, you could find Russians cut from every cloth crowded around that fountain, stumbling into conversations with whosoever happened to be at the neighboring table. Naturally, this has led to impromptu romances and heartfelt debates on the merits of Pushkin over Petrarch. Well, why, I've watched cabbies rub elbows with commissars and bishops with black marketeers. And on at least one occasion, I have actually seen a young lady change an old man's point of view." The Count pointed to a spot about 20 feet away.
"You see those two tables there? One afternoon in 1939, I watched as two strangers, finding each other vaguely familiar, spent their appetizer, entree, and dessert going over their entire lives step by step in search of the moment when they must have met. Looking around the restaurant with renewed appreciation, the architect observed, "I suppose a room is the summation of all that has happened inside it."
"Yes, I think it is," agreed the Count.
"And though I'm not exactly sure what has come of all the intermingling in this particular room, I'm fairly certain that the world has been a better place because of it." The Count was quiet for a moment as he too looked around. Then, pointing a finger, he directed the architect's attention to the bandstand on the far side of the room. "Have you ever happened to see the orchestra play here in the evening?"
"No, I haven't. Why?"
"The most extraordinary thing happened to me today." Apparently, he was walking down the hall when he had happened to hear a Mozart variation emanating from the ballroom. Intrigued, he poked his head inside and discovered Sophia at the keyboard.
"No,"
exclaimed Richard Vanderwyl. Naturally, the fellow asked where she was studying. He was taken aback to learn that she hadn't been studying with anyone. She had taught herself to play the piece by listening to one of the recordings you had given me, and then sounding out the notes one by one. Incredible. The fellow was so impressed with her natural abilities that he took her on as a student right there, then and there, and he has been teaching her the classical repertoire in the ballroom ever since.
"And this is the chap from the piazza, you say?"
"None other." "The one who waves the baton?"
"The very same."
Richard shook his head in wonder. "Audrius, have you heard all of this? We've got to raise a glass to the young lady as soon as possible. 2 goldenrods, my good man."
The ever-attentive bartender was already lining up bottles of various sizes, including yellow chartreuse, bitters, honey, and a vodka infused with lemon. On that night in 1946, when the Count and Richard had first become acquainted over Audrius's magenta concoction, the American had challenged the bartender to design a cocktail in each of the colors of St. Basil's Cathedral. Thus were born the goldenrod, the robin's egg, the brick wall, and a dark green potion called the Christmas tree. In addition, it had become generally known in the bar that anyone who could drink all 4 cocktails back to back earned the right to be called the Patriarch of all Russia, as soon as he regained consciousness. Though Richard, who was now attached to the State Department, tended to stay at the embassy when in Moscow, he would still stop by the Metropolitan occasion in order to have a nightcap with the Count. Thus, the goldenrods were poured and the two gentlemen clinked their glasses with the toast to old friends. Some might wonder that the two men should consider themselves to be old friends, having only known each other for 4 years. But the tenure of friendships has never been governed by the passage of time. These two would have felt like old friends had they just met hours before. To some degree, this was because they were kindred spirits, finding ample evidence of common ground and cause for laughter in the midst of effortless conversation. But it was also almost certainly a matter of upbringing. Raised in grand homes in cosmopolitan cities, educated in the liberal arts, graced with idle hours, and exposed to the finest things, though the Count and the American had been born 10 years and 4,000 miles apart, they had more in common with each other than they had with the majority of their own countrymen. This, of course, is why the grand hotels of the world's capitals all look alike. The Plaza in New York, the Ritz in Paris, Claridge's in London, the Metropole in Moscow. Built within 15 years of each other, they too were kindred spirits, the first hotels in their cities, with central heating, with hot water and telephones in the rooms, with international newspapers in the lobbies, international cuisines in the restaurants, and American bars off the lobby. These hotels were built for the likes of Richard Vanderwyl and Alexander Rostov, so that when they traveled to a foreign city, they would find themselves very much at home and in the company of kin. "I still can't believe it's that fellow from the piazza," said Richard with another shake of the head.
"I know," said the Count,
"but he actually studied at the conservatory here in Moscow, where he was the recipient of the Mussorgsky medal. He only conducts at the piazza in order to make ends meet."
"One must make ends meet," confirmed Audrius matter-of-factly,
"or meet one's end."
Richard studied the bartender for a moment.
"Well, That's the very essence of it, isn't it? Audrey shrugged, acknowledging that the essence of it was a bartender's stock in trade, and then he excused himself to answer the phone behind the bar. As he walked away, the Count seemed particularly struck by the bartender's remark. "Are you familiar with the Moths of Manchester?" he asked Richard. "The Moths of Manchester? Isn't that a soccer team?" "No," said the Count with a smile. "It is not a soccer team. It is an extraordinary case from the annals of the natural sciences that my father related to me as a child." But before the Count could elaborate, Audrius returned. "That was your wife on the phone, Mr. Vanderwyl. She asked me to remind you of your appointment in the morning and to alert you that your driver is waiting outside." Though most of the customers in the bar had never met Mrs. Vanderwyl, she was known to be as unflappable as Arcady, as attentive as Audrius, and as aware of whereabouts as Vasily, when it came to drawing Mr. Vanderwyl's evenings to a close. "Ah, yes," conceded Mr. Vanderwyl. Agreeing that duty comes first, the Count and Mr. Vanderwyl shook hands and wished each other well till next they met. When Richard left, the Count looked once around the room to see if there was anyone he knew, and was pleased to discover that the young architect from the piazza was at a table in the corner, bent over his sketchbook, presumably rendering the bar. He, too, thought the Count is one of the Moths of Manchester. When the Count was 9 years old, his father had sat him down in order to explain Darwin's theory of natural selection. As the Count listened, the essence of the Englishman's idea seemed perfectly intuitive. That over tens of thousands of years, a species would slowly evolve in order to maximize its chances of survival. After all, if the claws of a lion grow sharper, the gazelle had best grow more fleet of foot. But what had disconcerted the Count was when his father clarified that natural selection didn't need tens of thousands of years to take place. It didn't even need 100. It had been observed unfolding over the course of a few decades. "It was true," his father said, "that in a relatively static environment, the pace of evolution should decelerate, as individual species have little new to adapt to. But environments are never static for long. The forces of nature inevitably unleash themselves in such a manner that the necessity for adaptation will be stirred. An extended drought, an unusually cold winter, a volcanic eruption, any one of these could alter the balance between those traits that improve a species' chances for survival and those that hinder it. In essence, this is what had occurred in Manchester, England, in the 19th century, when the city became one of the first capitals of the Industrial Revolution. For thousands of years, the peppered moths of Manchester had white wings with black flecking. This coloring provided the species with perfect camouflage whenever they landed on the light gray bark of the region's trees. In any generation, there might be a few aberrations, such as a moth with pitch black wings, but when they were snapped off the trees by the birds, before they had a chance to mate. But when Manchester became crowded with factories in the early 1800s, the soot from the smokestacks began to settle on every conceivable surface, including the bark of the trees, and the lightly speckled wings that had served to protect the majority of peppered moths suddenly exposed them remorselessly to their predators, even as the darker wings of the aberrations rendered them invisible. Thus, the pitch black varieties that had represented less than 10% of the Manchester moth population in 1800 represented over 90% by the end of the century, or so explained the Count's father, with the pragmatic satisfaction of the scientifically minded. But the lesson did not sit well with the young Count. If this could happen so easily to moths, he thought, then what was to stop it from happening to children? What would happen to him and his sister, for instance, should they be exposed to excess chimney smoke or sudden extremes of weather? Couldn't they become victims of accelerated evolution? In fact, so disconcerted by this notion became the Count that when Idlehour was deluged by rainstorms that September, giant black moths harrowed his dreams. Some years later, the Count would come to understand that he had been looking at the matter upside down. The pace of evolution was not something to be frightened by, for while nature doesn't have a stake in whether the wings of a peppered moth are black or white,
it genuinely hopes that the peppered moth will persist. And that is why nature designed the forces of evolution to play out over generations rather than eons, to ensure that moths and men have a chance to adapt. Like Viktor Stepanovich, the Count reflected, a husband and father of two, he must make ends meet. So he waves his baton in the piazza, ostensibly putting the classical repertoire behind him. Then one afternoon, when he happens to stumble upon a young pianist with promise, in what little time he has to spare, he teaches her the nocturnes of Chopin on a borrowed piano. Just so, Mishka has his project, and this young architect, unable to build buildings, takes pride and pleasure from the careful drafting of hotel interiors in his sketchbook. For a moment, the Count considered going over to the young man, but he seemed to be applying his skills with such satisfaction that it would be a crime to interrupt him. So, instead, the Count emptied his glass, tapped the bar twice, and headed upstairs for bed. Of course, the Count was perfectly right, for when life makes it impossible for a man to pursue his dreams, he will connive to pursue them anyway. Thus, even as the Count was brushing his teeth, Viktor Stepanovich was setting aside an arrangement that he had been working on for his orchestra in order to sort through the Goldberg variations, in search of one that might be just right for Sofia. While in the village of Yavas, in a rented room not much larger than the Count's, by the light of a candle, Mikhail Mindish was sitting hunched over a table sewing another signature of 16 pages. And down in the Shilopin, the young architect continued to take pride and pleasure in his work, but contrary to the Count's supposition, he was not adding a rendering of the bar to his collection of hotel interiors. In fact, he was working in a different sketchbook altogether. On the first of this book's many pages was the design for a skyscraper 200 stories tall, with a diving board on the roof from which the tenants could parachute to a grassy park below. On another page was a cathedral to atheism with 50 different cupolas, several of which could be launched like rockets to the moon. And on another was a giant museum of architecture showcasing life-size replicas of all the grand old buildings that had been raised in the city of Moscow to make way for the new. But at this particular moment, what the architect was working on was a detailed drawing of a crowded restaurant that looked very much like the piazza. Only under the floor of this restaurant was an elaborate mechanics. Was an elaborate mechanics of axles, cogs, and gears, and jutting from an outside wall was a giant crank, at the turn of which each of the restaurant's chairs would pirouette like a ballerina on a music box, then spin around the space until they came to a stop at an entirely different table. And towering over this tableau, peering down through the glass ceiling, was a gentleman of 60 with his hand on the crank, preparing to set the diners in motion.
Part 2 of this section, as you can see, back in New York. Let's jump right in. Page 338. The year is 1952. This is titled America. On a Wednesday evening in late June, the Count and Sofia walked arm in arm into the Boyarsky, where it was their custom to dine on the Count's night off. Good evening, Andrei. Bonsoir, mon ami. Bonsoir, mademoiselle. Your table awaits. As Andrei ushered them into the dining room with a gesture of his hand, the Count could see it was another busy night. On the way to table 10, they passed the wives of two commissars seated at table 4. Dining alone at table 6 was an eminent professor of literature who they say had single-handedly wrestled the works of Dostoevsky to the ground, and at table 7 was none other than the beguiling Anna Urbanova in the company of the beguiled. Having successfully returned to the silver screen in the 1930s, in 1948 Anna had been lured back to the stage by the director of the Mali Theater. This was a stroke of good fortune for the 50-year-old actress, for while the silver screen showed a distinct preference for young beauties, the theater seemed to understand the virtues of age. After all, Medea, Lady Macbeth, Irina Arkadina, these were not roles for the blue-eyed and blushing.
They were roles for women who had known the bitterness of joy and the sweetness of despair. But Anna's return to the stage also proved fortunate for the Count, because instead of visiting the Metropole a few days a year, she was now in residence for months at a time, which allowed our seasoned astronomer to chart the newest of her constellations with the utmost care. Once the Count and Sophia had been seated, the two carefully studied their menus, working backward from entrees to appetizers, as was their custom. Placed their orders with Martin, who at the Count's recommendation had been promoted to the Boyarsky in 1942, and then finally turned their attention to the business at hand. Surely the span of time between placing of an order and the arrival of appetizers is one of the most perilous in all human interaction. What young lovers have not found themselves at this juncture in a silence so sudden, so seemingly insurmountable, that it threatens to cast doubt upon their chemistry as a couple? What husband and wife have not found themselves suddenly unnerved by the fear that they might never have something urgent, impassioned, or surprising to say to each other again? So it is with good reason that most of us meet this dangerous interstice with a sense of foreboding. But the Count and Sophia, they looked forward to it all day long, because it was the moment allotted for Zoot. A game of their own invention, Zoot's rules were simple. Player one proposes a category encompassing a specialized subset of phenomena, such as stringed instruments, or famous islands, or winged creatures other than birds. The two players then go back and forth until one of them fails to come up with a fitting example in a suitable interval of time, say 2.5 minutes. Victory goes to the first player, who wins 2 out of 3 rounds. And why was the name called Zoot? Because according to the Count, Zoot alors was the only appropriate exclamation in the face of defeat. That means like, oh damn. Thus, having searched throughout their day for challenging categories and carefully considered the viable responses, when Martin reclaimed the menus, father and daughter faced each other at the ready. Having lost the previous match, the Count had the right to propose the first category and did so with confidence. Famous foursomes. Well chosen, said Sophia. Thank you. They both took a drink of water. Then the Count began. The four seasons. The four elements. North, south, east, and west. Diamonds, clubs, hearts, and spades. Bass, tenor, alto, and soprano. Sophia reflected. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four evangelists.
Boreas, Zephyrus, Notos, and Eros, the four winds.
With an inward smile, the Count began counting the seconds, but he counted prematurely.
Yellow bile, black bile, blood, and phlegm, the four humors, said Sophia.
Très bien! Merci.
Sophia took a sip of water in order to obscure the hint of gloating on her lips, but now it was she who was celebrating prematurely.
The four horsemen of the apocalypse.
Ah, said Sophia with the sigh of one receiving a coup de grace, just as Martin arrived with the Chateau Yquem. Having presented the bottle, the waiter pulled the cork, poured a taste, and served the table.
Round two? Asked Sophia when Martin had departed.
With pleasure.
Animals that are black and white, such as the zebra.
Excellent, said the Count.
For a moment, he rearranged his silverware. He took a sip of wine and slowly returned his glass to the table.
Penguin, he said. Puffin.
Skunk.
Panda. The Count reflected, then smiled.
Killer whale.
The peppered moth, countered Sophia.
The Count sat up in indignation.
But that's my animal.
It is not your animal, but it is your turn.
The Count frowned.
Dalmatian, he exclaimed.
Now it was Sophia who arranged her silver and sipped her wine.
Time is passing, said the Count.
Me, said Sophia.
What?
With a tilt of her head, she held out the white stripe from her long black hair.
But you're not an animal.
Sophia smiled sympathetically, then said,
You're up.
Is there a black and white fish? The Count asked himself. A black and white spider? A black and white snake?
Tick-tock, tick-tock, said Sophia.
Yes, yes, wait a moment.
I know there is another black and white animal, thought the Count. It is something reasonably common. I've seen it myself. It's on the very tip of my... Do I have the pleasure of addressing Alexander Rostov?
The Count and Sophia both looked up in surprise. Standing before them was the eminent professor from table 6.
Yes, said the Count, rising from the table. I am Alexander Rostov. This is my daughter, Sophia.
I am Professor Matej Sirovich from Leningrad State University.
Of course you are, said the Count.
The professor gave a quick bow of the head in gratitude.
Like so many others, he continued, I am an admirer of your verse. Perhaps you would do me the honor of joining me for a glass of cognac after your meal?
It would be my pleasure.
I am in suite 317. I will be there within the hour.
Please, don't rush. The professor smiled and gently backed away from the table. Resuming his seat, the Count casually placed his napkin in his lap.
Matej Sirovich, he informed Sophia, is one of our most revered professors of literature, and apparently he would like to discuss poetry with me over a glass of cognac. What do you think of that?
I think your time is up.
The Count lowered his eyebrows. Yes, well, I had an answer sitting right on the tip of my tongue. I should have expressed it in another moment if we hadn't been interrupted.
Sophia nodded in the friendly manner of one who has no intention of considering the merits of an appeal.
All right, conceded the Count. One round apiece.
The Count took a kopeck from the ticket pocket of his vest and laid it on his thumbnail so that they could determine by toss who would get to choose the tie-breaking category. But before he could flip the coin, Martin appeared with their first course. Emile's interpretation of the Olivier salad for Sophia and goose liver pâté for the Count. Since they never played while they ate, the two turned their attention to an enjoyable discussion of the day's events. It was while the Count was spreading the last of his pâté on a corner of toast that Sophia observed rather casually that Anna Urbanova was in the restaurant.
What's that? Asked the Count.
Anna Urbanova, the actress. She's seated over there at table 7.
Is she?
The Count raised his head to look around the dining room with the curiosity of the idol, then returned to his spreading.
Why don't you ever invite her to join us for dinner?
The Count looked up with an expression of mild shock.
Invite her to dinner? Shall I invite Charlie Chaplin as well?
The Count gave a laugh and shake of the head. It is customary to be acquainted with someone before you invite them to dinner, my dear. Then he finished off the pâté just as he had finished off the conversation.
I think you're worried that I would be scandalized in some way, continued Sophia. But Marina thinks it's because...
Marina! Exclaimed the Count. Marina has an opinion on that. Why I would or wouldn't invite this Anna Urbanova to dine with us?
Naturally, Papa.
The Count leaned back in his chair.
I see. So what is this opinion that Marina so naturally has?
She thinks it's because you like to keep your buttons in their boxes.
My buttons in their boxes?
You know, your blue buttons in one box, your black buttons in another, your red buttons in a third. You have your relationships here, your relationships there, and you like to keep them distinct.
Is that so? I had no idea that I was known to treat people like buttons.
Not all people, Papa. Just your friends.
What a relief.
May I?
It was Martin, gesturing at the empty plates. Thank you, snapped the Count.
Sensing that he had interrupted a heated exchange, Martin quickly cleared the first course, returned with 2 servings of veal poyarski, topped up the wine glasses, and disappeared without a word. The Count and Sophia both breathed in the woody fragrance of the mushrooms, then began to eat in silence.
Emile has outdone himself, the Count said after a few bites.
He has, Sophia agreed. The Count took a generous swallow of the Chateau d'Yquem, which was a 1921 and perfectly suited to the veal.
Anna thinks it's because you're set in your ways.
The Count commenced to cough into his napkin, as he had determined long ago that this was the most effective means of removing wine from his windpipe.
Are you all right? Asked Sophia.
The Count put his napkin in his lap and waved a hand in the general direction of table 7.
And how, may I ask, do you know this Anna Urbanova thing? What this Anna Urbanova thinks?
Because she told me so.
So the two of you are acquainted?
But of course we are. We have known each other for years.
Well, that's just perfect, said the Count in a huff. Why don't you invite her to dinner? In fact, if I am such a button in a box, perhaps you, Marina, and Miss Urbanova should all have dinner on your own.
Why, that is exactly what Andrew suggested.
How is everything tonight?
Speak of the devil, shouted the Count as he dumped his napkin on his plate.
Taken aback, Andrew looked from the Count to Sophia with concern.
Is something wrong?
The food at the Boyarsky is superior, replied the Count, and the service is excellent. But the gossip, it is truly unsurpassed.
The Count stood.
I think you have some piano to practice to see to, young lady, he said to Sophia. Now, if you'll both excuse me, I am expected upstairs.
As the Count marched down the hallway, he could not help but observe to himself that there was a time not long before when a gentleman could expect a measure of privacy in his personal affairs. With reasonable confidence, he could place his correspondence in a desk drawer and leave his diary on a bedside table. Although, on the other hand, since the beginning of time, men in pursuit of wisdom had routinely retreated to mountaintops, caves, and cabins in the woods. So perhaps that is where one must eventually head if one has any hopes of achieving enlightenment without the interference of meddlers. Case in point, as the Count headed for the stairwell, who did he happen to bump into waiting for an elevator? None other than that renowned expert on human behavior, Anna Urbanova.
Good evening, Your Excellency, she said to the Count with a suggestive smile, but then her eyebrows rose in inquiry when she noted the expression on his face.
Is everything all right?
I can't believe that you have been having clandestine conversations with Sophia, the Count said in a hushed voice, though no one else was about.
They weren't clandestine, Anna whispered back.
They just happened to be while you were at work.
And you think that is somehow appropriate to foster a friendship with my daughter in my absence?
Well, you do like your buttons in their boxes, Sasha.
So I gather. The Count turned to go, but then came back. And if perchance I do like my buttons in their boxes, is there anything wrong with that?
Certainly not.
Would the world be a better place if we all kept all the buttons in a big glass jar? In such a world, whenever you tried to reach in for a button of a particular color, the tips of your fingers would inevitably push it down below the other buttons until you couldn't see it. Eventually, in a state of exasperation, you would end up pouring all of the buttons on the floor and then spend an hour and a half having to pick them back up.
Are we still talking about actual buttons now? Asked Anna with genuine interest, or is this still an allegory?
What is not an allegory, said the Count, is my appointment with an eminent professor, which, by the way, will necessitate the cancellation of any further appointments for the evening.
10 minutes later, the Count was knocking on that door which he had answered 1,000 times, but upon which he had never knocked.
Ah, here you are, said the professor. Please come in.
The Count had not been in his old suite in over 25 years, not since that night in 1926, when he had stood at the parapet. Still styled in the manner of a 19th-century French salon, the rooms remained elegant, if a little worse for wear. Only one of the 2 gilded mirrors now hung on the wall, the dark red curtains had faded, the matching couch and chairs needed to be reupholstered, and while his family clock still stood guard near the door, its hands were stopped at 4:22, having become an aspect of the room's decor rather than an essential instrument for the keeping of engagements. But if one no longer heard the gentle sound of time advancing in the suite, in its place were the strains of a waltz emanating from an electric radio on the dining room mantel. Following the professor into the sitting room, the Count habitually glanced at the northwest corner with its privileged view of the Bolshoi, and there, framed by the window, was the silhouette of a man gazing out into the night. Tall, thin, with an aristocratic bearing, it could have been a shadow of the Count from another time. But then the shadow turned and crossed the room with its hand outstretched.
Alexander!
Richard?
It was none other. Dressed in a tailored suit, Richard Vanderwyl smiled and took hold of the Count's hand.
It's good to see you. How long has it been? Almost 2 years?
From the dining room, the strains of the waltz grew a little louder.
The Count looked over just in time to see Professor Serovich closing the doors to his bedroom and turning the brass latch. Richard gestured to one of the chairs by the coffee table, on which was an assortment of zakuski. "Have a seat. I gather you've eaten, but you won't mind if I dig in, will you? I'm absolutely starving." Sitting on the couch, Richard put a slice of smoked salmon on a piece of bread and chewed it with relish, even as he spread caviar on a blini. "I saw Sophia from across the lobby this afternoon, and I couldn't believe my eyes. What a beauty she's become. You must have all the boys in Moscow knocking at your door." "Richard," said the Count with a wave of a hand at the room, "what are we doing here?" Richard nodded, brushing the crumbs from his hands. "I apologize for the theatrics. Professor Serovich is an old friend and generous enough to loan me his sitting room on occasion. I'm only in town for a few days, and I didn't want to miss the opportunity to speak with you in private, as I'm not exactly sure when I'll be back." "Has something happened?" the Count asked with concern. Richard put up both hands. "Not at all. In fact, they tell me it's a promotion. I'll be working out of the embassy in Paris for the next few years, overseeing a little initiative of ours, which is likely to keep me tied to a desk. Actually, Alexander, that's why I wanted to see you." Richard sat a little forward on the couch, putting his elbows on his knees. "Since the war, relations between our countries may not have been especially chummy, but they have been predictable. We launched the Marshall Plan, you launch the Molotov Plan. We form NATO, you form the Cominform. We develop an atom bomb, you develop an atom bomb. It's been like a game of tennis, which is not only a good form of exercise, but awfully entertaining to watch. Vodka?" Richard poured them both a glass. "Ça va," he said. "Ça va," replied the Count. The men emptied their glasses and Richard refilled them. "The problem is that your top player has played the game so well for so long, he's the only player we know. Were he to quit tomorrow, we'd have no idea which fellow would pick up his racket and whether he'd play from the baseline or the net." Richard paused. "You do play tennis?" "I'm afraid not." "Ah, right. The point is, comrade, Stalin appears to be on his last legs, and when he gives up his ghost, things are going to be very unpredictable. And not just in matters of international diplomacy, I mean right here in Moscow. Depending on who ends up in charge, the doors of the city could either be flung open to the world or slammed shut and bolted from the inside." "We must hope for the former," the Count declared. "Absolutely," agreed Richard. "We certainly have no business praying for the latter, but whatever happens, it is perfectly preferable to anticipate. Which brings us to the point of my visit. You see, the group I'll be heading in Paris is in the intelligence field. A sort of research unit, as it were, and we are looking for some friends here and there who might be in a position now and then to shed some light on this or that." "Richard," said the Count in some surprise, "you're not asking me to spy on my country." "What? Spy on your country? Absolutely not, Alexander. I like to think of it more as a form of cosmopolitan gossip. You know, who was invited to the dance and who showed up uninvited, who was holding hands at the corner and who got hot under the collar. The typical topics of a Sunday morning breakfast anywhere in the world. And in exchange for these sorts of trifles, we could prove generous to a fault." The Count smiled. "Richard, I am no more inclined to gossip than I am to spy. So let's not speak of this again, and we shall remain the best of friends." "To the best of friends, then," said Richard, clinking the Count's glass with his own. And for the next hour, the two men set aside the game of tennis and spoke instead of their lives. The Count spoke of Sophia, who was making wonderful strides at the conservatory and who remained so thoughtful and quiet. Richard spoke of his boys, who were making wonderful strides in the nursery and who remained neither thoughtful nor quiet. They spoke of Paris and Tolstoy and Carnegie Hall. Then at 9 o'clock, these two kindred spirits rose from their seats. "It's probably best if you see yourself out," said Richard. "Oh, and should it ever come up, you and Professor Serovich had a lengthy debate on the future of the sonnet. You were in favor, he was against." After they'd shaken hands, the Count watched Richard disappear into the bedroom. Then he turned toward the door to let himself out. But as he passed the grandfather clock, he hesitated. How loyally it had stood in his grandmother's drawing room and sounded the time for tea, for supper, for bed. On Christmas Eve, it had signaled the moment when the Count and his sister could slide apart the seamless doors. Opening the narrow glass door in the clock's cabinet, the Count reached inside and found the little key still on its hook. Inserting it into the keyhole, the Count wound the clock to its limit, set the time, and gave the pendulum a nudge, thinking, "Let the old man keep time for a few hours more." Almost 9 months later, on the 3rd of March, 1953, the man known variously as Dear Father, Vozhkova, Soso, or simply Stalin, would die in his Kuntsevo residence in the aftermath of a stroke. The following day, workmen and trucks laden down with flowers arrived at the Palace of Unions on Theater Square, and within a matter of hours, the building's facade was adorned with a portrait of Stalin 3 stories high. On the 6th, Harrison Salisbury, the new Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times, stood in the Count's old rooms, now occupied by the Mexican chargé d'affaires, to watch as members of the presidium arrived in a cavalcade of ZIM limousines, and as Soso's coffin, taken from a bright blue ambulance, was borne ceremoniously inside. And on the 7th, when the Palace of Unions was opened to the public, Salisbury watched in some amazement as the line of citizens waiting to pay their respects stretched 5 miles across the city. Why many Western observers wondered, would over a million citizens stand in line to see the corpse of a tyrant? The flippant said it must have been to ensure that he was actually dead. But such a remark did not do justice to the men and women who waited and wept. In point of fact, legions mourned the loss of the man who had led them to victory in the great patriotic war against the forces of Hitler. Legions more mourned to the loss of the man who had so single-mindedly driven Russia to become a world power, while others simply wept in recognition that a new era of uncertainty had begun. For, of course, Richard's prediction proved perfectly right. When Soso breathed his last, there was no plan of succession, no obvious designé. Within the presidium, there were 8 different men who could reasonably claim the right to lead. Minister of Security, Beria, Minister of the Armed Forces, Bulganin, Deputy Chairman of the Council of Ministers, Malenkov, Minister of Foreign Trade, Mikoyan, Foreign Minister Molotov, Secretariat members Kaganovich and Voroshilov, and even former mayor of Moscow, Nikita Khrushchev, that blunt, brutish, and bald apparatchik who not long before had perfected the 5-story concrete apartment building. Much to the relief of the West, it seemed in the aftermath of the funeral that the man most likely to prevail was the progressive internationalist and outspoken critic of nuclear arms, Malenkov, because, like Stalin, he was appointed as both premier of the party and general secretary of the Central Committee, but a consensus quickly formed within the party's upper ranks that no one man should ever be allowed to simultaneously hold both of these positions again. So, 10 days later, party premier Malenkov was forced to pass his chairmanship of the secretariat to the conservative Khrushchev, setting the stage for a duumvirate of antagonists, a delicate balance of authority between 2 men of contrary views and ambiguous alliances, which would keep the world guessing for a few years to come. How can anyone live his life in expectation of the latter? Despite having announced that he would have no more time for appointments that evening, when the Count asked this question, he was in Anna Urbanova's bed. I know there is something quixotic in dreaming of the former, he continued, but when all is said and done, if the former is even a remote possibility, then how can one submit to the likelihood of the latter? To do so would be contrary to the human spirit. So fundamental is our desire to catch a glimpse of another way of life, or to share a glimpse of our way of life with another, that even when the forces of the latter have bolted the city's doors, the forces of the former will find a means to slip through the cracks. The Count reached over, borrowed on a cigarette, and took a puff. Having thought for a moment, he waved the cigarette at the ceiling. In recent years, I have waited on Americans who have traveled all the way to Moscow to attend one performance at the Bolshoi. Meanwhile, our haphazard little trio in the Shilopin will take a stab at any little bit of American music they've heard on the radio. These are unquestionably the forces of the former on display. The Count took another puff. When Emil is in his kitchen, does he cook the latter? Of course not. He simmers, sears, and serves the former. A veal from Vienna, a pigeon from Paris, or a seafood stew from the south of France. Or consider the case of Viktor Stepanovich. You're not going to start in on the moths of Manchester again. No, said the Count peevishly. I am making a different point entirely. When Viktor and Sofia sit down at the piano, do they play Mussorgsky? Wait. Do they play Mussorgsky and Mussorgsky? No. They play Bach and Beethoven, Rossini and Puccini. While at Carnegie Hall, the audience responds to Horowitz's performance of Tchaikovsky with thunderous applause. The Count turned on his side to study the actress. You're keeping unusually quiet, he said, returning her cigarette. Perhaps you don't agree? Anna took a drag and slowly exhaled. It's not that I disagree with you, Sasha, but I'm not so sure that one can simply dance away one's life to the tune of the former, as you call it. Certain realities must be faced wherever you live, and in Russia that may mean a bit of bending to the latter. Take your beloved bouillabaisse, or that ovation in Carnegie Hall. It is no coincidence that the cities from which your examples spring are port cities, Marseille and New York. I dare say you could find similar examples in Shanghai and Rotterdam. But Moscow is not a port, my love. At the center of all that is Russia, of its culture, its psychology, and perhaps its destiny, stands the Kremlin, a walled fortress 1,000 years old and 400 miles from sea. Physically speaking, its walls are no longer high enough to fend off attack, and yet they still cast a shadow across the entire country. The Count rolled onto his back and stared at the ceiling. Sasha, I know you don't want to accept the notion that Russia may be inherently inward-looking, but do you think in America they're even having this conversation? Wondering if the gates of New York are about to be opened or closed? Wondering if the former is more likely than the latter? By all appearances, America was founded on the former. They don't even know what the latter is. You sound as if you dreamed of living in America. Everyone dreams of living in America. That's ridiculous. Ridiculous. Half of the inhabitants of Europe would move there tomorrow just for the conveniences. Conveniences? What conveniences? Turning on her side, Anna tamped out her cigarette, opened the drawer on the bedside table, and produced a large American magazine, which the Count noted was rather presumptuously entitled Life. Flipping through the pages, Anna began pointing to various brightly colored photographs. Each one seemed to show the same woman in a different dress smiling before some newfangled contraption. Dishwashing machines, clothes washing machines, vacuum cleaners, toasters, televisions, and look here, an automatic garage door. What is an automatic garage door? It is a garage door that opens and closes itself on your behalf. What do you think of that? I think if I were a garage door, I should rather miss the old days. Anna lit another cigarette and handed it to the Count. He took a drag and watched the smoke spiral toward the ceiling where the muses looked down from the clouds. I'll tell you what is convenient, he said after a moment. To sleep until noon and to have someone bring you your breakfast on a tray. To cancel an appointment at the very last minute. To keep a carriage waiting at the door of one party so that on a moment's notice it can whisk you away to another. To sidestep marriage in your youth and put off having children altogether. These are the greatest of conveniences, Anushka. And at one time, I had them all. But in the end, it has been the inconveniences that have mattered to me most. Anna Urbanova took the cigarette from the Count's fingers, dropped it in a water glass, and kissed him on the nose. And we'll stop there for this section, and picking up on page 353 next time. I'm hoping that we can get through the rest of the book in like four more sections. Fingers crossed. All right. Hope you're enjoying. Bye.